Well, we are going to press on then into the 19th century, the 1800s. And I feel like this is really where the Christian landscape starts to take on a familiar aspect to us. We who have lived through some of the 20th century here into the 21st. This is the point in the 19th century where, particularly for us as Baptists, for really anyone who has a foot in American evangelicalism, this is kind of where that milieu develops in its full form, is the 1800s. So we're going to look at that. Like we've done going through, one of the things I want to bring out is we got someone joining us here. Good. One of the things I want to bring out of this is, you know, how the denominations around us developed. So that, you know, when you see a Plymouth Brethren Church or a Christian Missionary Alliance Church or any of those things, a Wesleyan Church, you know, these are all groups that kind of have their roots from this story. So we're going to be looking at some of that tonight. I'm going to start us out in Europe, though, but we'll be spending much of our time here in North America, the story over here, or the global context. But just to kind of set the stage, in Europe in the 1800s, you've got major social disruptions happening, and they're happening fast by the 1800s. So you have political revolutions, the French Revolution at the end of the 1700s, which develops into the Napoleonic Wars. And then as you go through the 19th century, you get other revolutions that happen in 1830 and 1848. Just a lot of kind of political, social upheaval. And at the same time, you got a lot of cultural upheaval too. What we call the Industrial Revolution was really picking up steam. I was going to say no pun intended, but maybe it was. I just thought of that. Industrial Revolution, picking up steam with all of its steam locomotives. And that really was changing the culture. You know, we talked a little bit last time and the time before about the way a lot of Christians grew up in a parish structure, where you're just kind of in an area and you've got a church that's the church of that area. Well, with the Industrial Revolution, you start getting people who are moving, migrating to cities, migrating to industrial centers. It's a much more fluid society, more like what we have today. And that leads away from some of that old parish model. Along the way with scientific progress, it's not just technological progress with the Industrial Revolution. You also get more and more of kind of scholars at universities starting to dig into and question the historical roots of Christian doctrine. And so we're going to look at that by the end of our session tonight, at the way that that trend kind of produced what we now call theological liberalism, or the liberal Christian tradition. Liberal and conservative are terms we throw around a lot politically. As you'll see here, liberalism also has a meaning in theology, and it sometimes overlaps with political liberalism, but it's not exactly the same thing. So we want to understand what that means and where it comes from. And then the other big movement in Europe and on the world stage was colonialism. This was the century where you really had not just European powers sending out, you know, trading vessels and vessels of discovery, but now you have them just claiming big chunks of the world. Spain had already done that. Portugal had already done that in Latin America. Now you have Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, countries like this who are just sort of carving up big chunks of Africa and claiming them for themselves, or Southeast Asia, or wherever. So that also plays into the dynamics of this period. I wanted to mention Eastern Orthodoxy again. We haven't talked about them much, but they haven't gone away. They've been there doing their thing since the fall of Constantinople, centered in Eastern Europe, Greece, Russia. But they start to kind of take a bigger role in the global Christian story starting in the 19th century again. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that the Ottoman Empire, so that Muslim Turkish Empire that controlled a huge portion of Eastern Europe, the Balkans and Greece, its power was starting to wane. And you were getting independence movements in Eastern Europe. Greece is liberated near the beginning of this century that we're talking about. In some of these other countries, Bulgaria and Romania, you're just getting a lot more freedom for the Eastern Orthodox Church than they've had for centuries. And at the same time, you have Russia rising as a world power in a way that it hadn't before. So this is the age of Imperial Russia, with its czars. You had a little bit of that back in the 1700s as well, but it becomes a real big deal in the 1800s. And so Eastern Orthodoxy, as kind of one of the major forms of Christianity, really becomes, starts exerting its influence more in the 1800s. You have great novelists like Dostoevsky, whose books, for instance, The Brothers Karamazov, is just rich with Eastern Orthodox theology. You have great saints of the Eastern Orthodox tradition, like a man named Seraphim of Sarov. He's almost like the Francis of Assisi for the Eastern Orthodox tradition. One of this beautiful, charismatic, winsome guy who loves the Lord, loves nature. During this period, you also have some Orthodox missions. So they were the first to send out missionaries to plant any form of Christianity in Alaska. So they went all the way through Russia from the other side and were introducing Orthodox Christianity to the, oh, here's Misha. Let him in here. Okay. Introducing Eastern Orthodoxy to some of the native groups of Alaska. So I'm not going to talk a lot about Eastern Orthodoxy. I just want to remind you that they're there. We're not spending a lot of time on their story because it's, you know, our story here in America tends in a different direction, but they are definitely still there. I do want to spend a couple minutes talking about Roman Catholicism. The textbook has a chapter on this. I marked it as optional in your reading because there was a lot of reading for this session. So some of you may have done it, some of you may not have. But there's a couple interesting developments in the Roman Catholic Church that are worth understanding, that really shape who Catholics are now. One of the things is that they're just kind of running up against this rationalism of the Enlightenment modern world, which was really big in France. And of course, France is also a traditional Catholic country. And so you're starting to get this tension against skeptics and secular scholars questioning some of the roots of the church. And the Catholic Church did not respond to this with what we might call openness of mind. And I mean, that's their right. They can do it however they want. But instead of like, say, starting a dialogue, the Pope instead kind of just issued these bulls, these ecclesiastical pronouncements that listed all the ways the modern world was wrong and how the Catholic Church was not going to change. Okay. That's played out in several different ways. Some of that philosophy was lessened a bit in this past century, 20th century. The story of Vatican II, which we'll get to, really kind of did loosen some of that perspective up, where they decided that wasn't necessarily the right approach to the modern world, and they wanted to at least have dialogues. But the two big developments in doctrine during this period for Roman Catholicism are papal infallibility and the Immaculate Conception, right? And both of these had kind of already been there in the Catholic tradition. They're not pulling these out of thin air. There was a long-standing, just sort of popular devotional tradition about Mary, that Roman Catholics said that Mary had been conceived without the stain of original sin. So that means when they refer to the Immaculate Conception, they're actually referring to Mary's birth as a child, not to her pregnancy bearing Jesus. It's about Mary being born and how God gave a special dispensation of grace to her parents, Joachim and Anna. So it's not a virgin birth. It's not the same as Jesus's, but Catholics have long believed that God did something miraculous to protect her from the stain of original sin. Obviously, there's nothing from Scripture where you can get that from, but there are some old church traditions that they draw from. They've often held it, but it was at this point in the mid-1800s where the Pope finally came out and said, yes, this is dogma. That means not only is this a popular theological opinion, this is what every Catholic has to believe. If you are a Roman Catholic, you are required to hold to this position about the birth of the Virgin Mary, the Immaculate Conception. This raised another question, though, because the Pope came out and kind of did this himself. And traditionally, the way dogma was created was not just the Pope saying whatever he wanted to say. It was that you had the Pope with the magisterium, the council of other bishops and cardinals in Rome, and you have these conciliar statements. For instance, you know, think about the ecumenical church councils from the early church, or more recently, the Council of Trent, that they used to kind of push back against the Protestant Reformation. Well, the Pope had done this one without calling a council. And so eventually they did call a council. We call it the First Vatican Council, 1870. And it was there to not only back up what the Pope had said about the Immaculate Conception, but also to verify that, yes, he has the authority to do this. And so that's what they mean when they say papal infallibility. They mean that the Pope has authority within the Roman Catholic Church structure, authority all of his own, apart from any other bishops or councils, to declare what is the binding teaching of the Catholic Church, just him alone. That had always kind of been there, or at least, it, you know, papal authority, as we've seen, has developed over the centuries. So it wasn't a huge surprise, but this was the first time it had kind of been laid out by that. And it wasn't embraced completely with open arms. There were actually a few churches that broke off from the Roman Catholic Church at this time. Not a lot, but a few. They were referred to as the old Catholic churches. If you ever do a Google search on those, they'll come up. They're now kind of, you know, sort of mainline churches in Europe. But there's a prominent one in the Netherlands, a denomination that's called the Old Catholic Church. And there's a few others out there too. And they split away at this time because they didn't feel like that teaching about papal infallibility was true. It's useful to know, though, that when Catholics talk about papal infallibility, they don't mean that it applies all the time to everything that gets said. So, for instance, Pope Francis, the current pope, he drives some Catholics crazy because he'll just, you know, be out in public and he'll say some things off the cuff to reporters who are asking him questions. And then the whole world gets these media stories like, Pope Francis said such and such on this issue. Pope Francis thinks this about whatever it is, you know, all these issues they're dealing with culture and sexuality and so on. And he's very free to say things, but a lot of Catholics wish he would keep kind of a tighter lip in the public media on those things. But one of the things that's important to remember is that when he's doing that, Catholics don't look at that and say, oh, papal infallibility, everything that comes out of his mouth is the word of God. That's not what they mean. What they mean is it's still kind of a very strictly limited window. So it's defined only as when the Pope is speaking ex cathedra, which is a Latin term that means from the chair, sort of officially, consciously stating a position from the authority of the throne of St. Peter, right? And so it really only comes to bear with certain kinds of high-level documents, papal bulls, or sometimes encyclicals, although even that is kind of nebulous. Pope Francis wrote an encyclical a few years back, and if you ask Catholics about it, you know, is this document, I forget what the name was, Amoris Laetitiae, something like that, is this document now the official teaching of the Catholic Church? Does it fall under that infallibility principle? Most of them will say either no or we don't know yet. So they still give themselves some kind of wiggle room in there. So, interesting, worth knowing about. The Pope is considered infallible, but only in a highly specific sense. So that's what the Roman Catholics are up to. We'll have more to say about them, especially in our final session, next time we get together. For Anglicanism, in Britain, during this period, it's kind of continuing to explore its identity. That's the way I put it. You remember we talked about the English Reformation as this sort of pendulum swing. Some people really want it to be much more Catholic in its form, high church, liturgical. Some others want it to be more low church. The Puritan tradition was certainly that way. Well, this is still going on. You've still got the pendulum swing back and forth. During the 1800s, you get a little bit more of the high church pushback. We talked about Puritans last time. They're a low church tradition. In the 1800s, you start getting some high church movements in Anglicanism, particularly one that's called the Oxford Movement, where these high-ranking scholars and clergymen from Oxford University start publishing writings that suggest that Anglican documents can be interpreted in a way that's faithful to the Roman Catholic tradition. And so they're trying to push it kind of back in that high church Catholic direction. They have an impact, but they don't win everybody over. In fact, the leading character, John Henry Newman, ends up converting to Catholicism. Anglicanism itself doesn't go all the way there, but you do still today. Even if you look across the scope of the Anglican Church, you can get really, really high church expressions, like, you know, the Archbishop of Canterbury in Canterbury Cathedral. That's a very sort of high church worship service if you went there. Or low church. You could walk into John Stott's old church in London, All Souls. It's an Anglican church, but you walk in there and it feels kind of like a Baptist worship service. Maybe like a high-class Baptist worship service, but, you know, a Baptist worship service. So you still get some of this back and forth in Anglicanism. You also have, we talked last time about the development of the evangelical tradition, right? So with the Baptists, with John Wesley and his preaching, and the evangelical revival in Britain, you've got this new movement that kind of spans across several different denominations of people who are really committed to Scripture, really committed to evangelism, committed to this sense of the gospel as the one that, you know, probably is forefront of mind for most of us. That Jesus Christ died for our sins, and he now, through the forgiveness of your sins, opens up a way for you to have a personal experience of faith with him. That's a very evangelical way of putting it. But that was the perspective that was growing and thriving in England at this time. So you have, I noted two groups there to begin with, the Clapham sect, which your textbook goes into in great detail. So that's William Wilberforce, the anti-slavery guy, and his friends. Really prominent evangelical leaders who do a tremendous amount of good. They're involved not only in the abolition of slavery, they're involved in education reform, labor reform, prison reform. They're really out to change the face of their culture for the gospel of Jesus Christ, and profoundly effective at doing it too. It's a really hopeful story. They're near the beginning of the 1800s. By the end of the 1800s, another evangelical figure that I wanted to highlight for you, because I really can't talk about the 1800s without talking about him, is Charles Spurgeon. And he's probably familiar to some of you already. I'm going to share my screen here. And I'm going to come over to Spurgeon. Let's see. Can you guys see that? Charles Spurgeon? So Charles Spurgeon is a Baptist, one of the most famous Baptists in history. He's known as the Prince of Preachers. And he is very prominent in the latter half of the 1800s. In London. He's a pastor in London at a church called the Metropolitan Tabernacle, and is really what you might call one of the first mega church pastors of the day. That's a term that wasn't used back then, but in terms of the number of people that he reached, it was truly phenomenal. And if you ever get a chance to read some of his writings, read his sermons, do it, because just the way he is able to put the truths of the gospel in elegant, beautiful terminology, it's really inspiring. You can tell why people love this guy. One of the reasons why Spurgeon was really important is that, you know, he's representing this traditional view of the Bible and Christianity in the middle of London, which was, you know, right at the center of some of this Enlightenment, modernist skepticism. And so over against the scholars that are starting to question historical roots of the Christian faith, he really was a very prominent voice that just tirelessly proclaimed the faith that, you know, as Jude says in his letter, the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. There's a picture of Spurgeon preaching. This isn't his own church. This is the Royal Music Hall. But you can see just how many people would come out to hear him. And consider this too. I mean, he's preaching to these massive crowds in a time where they don't have electronic amplification. They don't have microphones. I know in my church, you know, it's nothing near the size of this crowd. And when my microphone goes out, I've got a pretty decent voice, but people always tell me, we can't hear you. Charles Spurgeon must have had an amazing voice just to be able to reach this kind of crowd day in and day out. He gave credit to his church, especially a small group of people who would pray for him while he preached. Whenever someone stopped by who was interested in his ministry, he would show them around the church, but he would always take them down to like a little room, almost like, I'm thinking of it as the boiler room. I don't know if there was a boiler there or not, but this kind of little basement room that sat underneath where his pulpit was on the next level up. And he said, this is the most important room in the whole church. And he says, when I preach, I have a handful of faithful saints down here who are praying for me the whole time. And success in my ministry is far more attributable to them than to me. So he really exemplified that kind of humility, even in the midst of his own tremendous gifts. Another part of his story that's worth knowing is that he also struggled with what we would probably now call depression. This is, you know, something he wrestled with, and he didn't quite understand it all the time, but I think it's a really hopeful thing for Christians who sometimes deal with seasons of depression to know that there are really exemplary figures in the history of the church who have also been struck by these things and really have it, you know, it was difficult for him, but persevered in resting and trusting in Christ, even in the midst of all that. These quotes that I put here, I just give you kind of a sense of the way he could use words. This picture, this is above the picture of him as a young man preaching. He says, "If sinners be damned, at least let them leap to hell over our bodies. And if they perish, let them perish with our arms about their knees, imploring them to stay. If hell must be filled, at least let it be filled in the teeth of our exertions, and let not one go there unwarned and unprayed for. So you get a sense for the dynamism of his preaching, and also the way he really encouraged people to be dynamic in their spiritual lives. Get out there, you know, talk about the gospel with those around you. So he is a major figure in the story of the Baptist Church, of the evangelical movement more broadly, and of British Christianity. So I wanted to make sure we touched on him. Now I'm going to shift gears and talk a little bit about global Christianity, because the 1800s are also this time where Christianity makes this leap to... It had always been a global religion, you know, as we've seen. There were Church of the East Christians as far as China in the first millennium. But for a long time, Europe was kind of the central powerhouse of Christianity, if you can use that terminology. Of course, always were Christians in the Middle East. There still are today, ancient Christian churches. Always Christians in Africa. The Coptic Church in Egypt, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, those were there during this period as well. But in this period, you get that missionary movement that introduces Christianity to places where it's never been before, in areas of sub-Saharan Africa, India, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and many other areas as well. So I'm going to touch on William Carey. I think I brought him up a little bit last time, but I wanted to come back around to him because he really is a seminal figure in the launch of the modern mission movement, the Protestant mission movement. And he too is a Baptist, so he's part of our particular tradition. During the 1700s in England, there really wasn't much push at all for what we might call foreign missions or overseas missions. It just really wasn't thought of. The Anglicans were sending out some chaplains to overseas colonies, but those chaplains really didn't do a whole lot in terms of reaching out across cultures to different language groups. It's really with William Carey that you get that first movement among English-speaking Christians. He was inspired by the Moravians a little bit. We talked about them last time. But he really wanted his English-speaking churches, you know, Baptists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, who had never been active in mission, to think about sending out missionaries. And so he wrote an influential book. It's called The Enquiry, an enquiry into the obligations of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathens. And not only did he write this book, but then he also went as the first missionary. So he's not just the ideas man, he's the goer and the doer. His primary innovation in the history of missions is what we call the voluntary society. So instead of a denomination sending out missionaries, like for instance I mentioned the Anglicans had kind of been sending out chaplains to their colonial provinces, instead of just a denomination doing that, Carey says, hey, all these churches that we have, Baptist churches, Congregationalists, etc., we can band together to form a society in which we are able to send out... Sorry, excuse me, I've got a phone ringing in the background. I'm just going to let that go. We're able to bring together a society in which lay people can volunteer if they feel called to go to the missionary field. They can come to our society, we'll kind of vet them, we'll train them, and then we'll send them out. Doesn't have to be clergy, doesn't have to be, you know, a specific appointment of a denomination. We can do this on our own. And so they did. He founds a society in the early 1790s, and within just a few years, there's more and more of them that develop. First in England, and then in the U.S. as well. So after these missionary societies develop, he's a missionary in India, and there's a really very poor image quality of him baptizing an Indian Christian. And he's a Bible translator as well. He's working for the spread of the gospel in India. And one of the things that's worth understanding about this at first is that this really was revolutionary. I mean, there was some colonial involvement in India. The British East India Company was there, but they were interested in commerce. They weren't interested in missions. And the East India Company, this British institution, in many ways resisted the missionary impulse. They thought that it would disrupt Indian society and would prevent them from making money off of the native people. And so they gave William Carey a really hard time. His famous quote is this one underneath the picture here. Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. That's, you know, if you ever look up William Carey, that's kind of the one quote that always floats to the top. So, major figure in launching the Protestant mission movement. And then you got others. You got some very prominent ones from the U.S. coming. And one of the most prominent ones was this guy here, Adoniram Judson. And again, another major figure from our Baptist tradition. And on top of that, a New Englander. So I'm going to be pointing out a few places tonight where the story of Christianity in the 1800s has major influences on Maine, or major influences from Maine in some instances. Adoniram Judson was a New Englander, Massachusetts. I think his wife was from New Hampshire. He becomes the first foreign overseas missionary from the U.S. And he's sent out by a group that was just getting started, the first really voluntary society in the U.S. I think I put it on your note sheet. ABCFM, that stands for American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. That sounds really important and formal, but it really started out as just this beautiful movement of God amongst a little group of college students. The story of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions started at Andover Newton, which was a seminary here in New England. And these college kids were kind of out in the field, walking around, having a good time, as college students will. And suddenly there was a massive rainstorm that broke out. And so they're looking for shelter in the midst of this rainstorm so they don't get just doused. And they dive into a haystack, a big old haystack. They kind of burrow into it, make a space for themselves there, and they just sit there in haystack to wait out the storm. While they're in there, waiting for this rain to let up, they decide to, you know, hey, we're stuck in here. We got to use the time somehow. Let's start praying. Let's start praying for the world. And so this is what's referred to as the haystack prayer meeting. A bunch of college kids under a haystack starting to pray for the world. And this experience of praying together for the nations just fires them up to such a degree that they start advocating for the formation of a mission society. And that becomes eventually the ABCFM, American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. So it's one of these stories where just from really small, ordinary beginnings, these college kids having a prayer meeting on the spur of a moment, it just develops into something that has an amazing impact for the kingdom of God. Well, anyway, Adoniram Judson gets sent out, and initially he wants to go to India, like William Carey had, but ends up going to Burma. His story was interesting. He began as a Congregationalist, but while he's on the ship, riding over to Burma, he's reading some books by Baptists and falls under the conviction that, oh man, you know what? I think those Baptists might actually have the Bible right. And so he transfers from Congregationalist to Baptist while he's sailing to the mission field. And this was problematic because he had already gotten a whole bunch of Congregationalist churches to agree to support him. So he has to send one of his mission team members back to start going around to Baptist churches and say, so Baptists, you might not know this, but you have the first foreign overseas missionary from America, and he needs your help. So Luther Rice is the name of the man who kind of organized the Baptist churches after the fact to support Adoniram and Ann Judson. Adoniram and Ann Judson labor in Burma, what's now the country of Myanmar, for decades, and it's slow work. I mean, when we're talking about Burma, we're not talking about some kind of, you know, primitive society or anything like that. Actually, I studied cultural anthropology. I wouldn't even call any society primitive. They're all remarkably complex once you dig into them. But when we get to Burma, we're actually talking about a civilization, an empire in Southeast Asia that has a powerful king, that has its own religious tradition, Buddhism, that's been set in stone for centuries upon centuries. So the missionary work there is really slow and laborious. It doesn't make a lot of converts right away. He, like Carey, he is a prominent Bible translator. His Burmese Bible is still kind of regarded as sort of like the King James Version for Burmese Christians over there. Excuse me. His importance really was in getting the ball started and in telling his story back here in the U.S. His writings and his wife's writings would come back, and churches back here in America were eating this stuff up. They were firing up a whole generation of missionaries. So even though he had a very difficult road as a missionary, he was shocked when he came back on furlough in time and found out that he was a celebrity in the United States. Just crowds upon crowds coming out to meet him everywhere that he went. In fact, I think if I remember right, there's actually a relic of his, I forget what it is, a hat or a cane or something like that, in the Damariscotta Baptist Church. Some of you who are in that area might want to check it out or ask the pastor, because I remember seeing it there once. It's on one of Adoniram Judson's visits or something. They got this this memento from his stop over there. But he got the ball rolling, and eventually he got some people to come along as part of his mission team to Burma. And foremost among them were some Maine connections. George and Sarah Boardman. The Boardmans are from our area, Maine and New Hampshire. In fact, Boardman is still a prominent name in certain parts of Maine today, a prominent family name. So they join Adoniram Judson's mission to Burma, and instead of going to the Burmese people, the people group that had the empire, essentially, they decide to go up into the mountains in the eastern part of the country and evangelize the Karen tribe. And what they find is just extraordinary. Whereas Judson's ministry had been really slow and laborious, not many converts, the Boardmans, particularly Sarah Boardman, George passes away before too long. But, sorry guys, can you still hear me? I'm getting a message that my internet connection is unstable. You can still hear me okay?
Right now.
Yeah, we lost you for about, you know, 5-10 seconds.
Okay. All right. Seems like it's back on now. I can see all of you moving, so I'll keep an eye on that. George and Sarah Boardman, they go into the Karen tribe, and their presentation of the gospel is embraced with open arms. And I write about it down here. There's actually an interesting myth in the Karen people group that explains why they embrace Christianity so quickly. I'll just read it here. Karen legends include an interesting creation story. They believed in a creator, Yahweh, which is interesting too, because it's very similar to the biblical Hebrew name for God. They believed in a creator, Yahweh, who made three kinds of people. The Karen, who were the elder brothers. They thought of themselves as the first people group. The Burmese, and light-skinned younger brothers who lived in distant lands. Yahweh had given a special book to each group, but the Karen had lost their group. They believed that one day their light-skinned younger brothers would come to them and reintroduce them to the lost book of God. Well, so that's a folk story that Perez grew up learning about. And then here comes George and Sarah Boardman walking through the jungles saying that they have a book that God has intended for all peoples, and they're here to tell the message. Well, so the Karens came en masse into Christianity, and the related group, the Kachins, also did as well. So one of the interesting things about Burma, you see Myanmar in the news a lot today. One of the things you should know about Myanmar is that we have a tremendous number of Baptist brothers and sisters there. The Karens and the Kachins in particular. They're subject to a great deal of violence right now by the Myanmar government. But even now, even though Myanmar is officially a Buddhist country, officially closed to the gospel, Myanmar, Burma, is one of the biggest Baptist countries in the world, if you're counting Baptist population. And it goes back to this amazing mission story. So anyway, that's the Boardmans from Maine. You had a few other, I won't spend a lot of time on these guys, but a few other prominent early missionaries who were involved in Bible translation. I'll just mention them quickly. Henry Martin was one, an Anglican guy, went over to India, but just had an amazing brain for linguistics. And so he's translating the New Testament into Urdu, into Persian, into a Persian form of Hebrew. And he's learning these languages just within a few years of being there. Passes away really young, which is a tragedy. But like Adoniram and Ann Judson, the story of his sacrifice and his devotion really gets publicized, inspires a lot of people to step up to the plate and consider missionary service. Another one is this guy, Robert Morrison. Went to China and translated the Bible into Chinese, which was a tremendous work. I mean, if you've ever seen or studied Chinese before, not only the language itself is challenging, it's a tonal language, which means that the meaning of words change not only based on the phonetic sounds you're using, but also on the tone of your voice. If your tone is rising, if your tone is falling, if your tone is rising and falling, or if it's staying flat, the same word can have very different meanings in all of those cases. And of course, its system of writing is just intricate and complex. There's an old story about Robert Morrison that he was just bewildered by the complexity of Chinese when he went as a missionary and started to work on this project. And so it's said that eventually in frustration, he took his Chinese dictionary and his book of Chinese grammar that he was trying to learn the languages from, put them on the floor, and he said, "Lord, in the book of Joshua, you told your people that you would give them everywhere they set their feet." So steps onto the books, he says, "I'm setting my feet here, Lord. Give me this territory." What he meant by that was the grammar, the language of Chinese. Get it into my head. Well, eventually, either through hard work or miraculous help, or both, he did learn Chinese and was able to make a Bible translation, which really opened the way for more work in China. You also, let's see what I have next, Christianity and colonialism. So one of the big questions that comes up about missionary work today, they look back at the 1800s and they say, well, it's kind of a dark tale of, you know, European powers going in, just brutally taking over and forcing these native societies in Asia and Africa to follow European ways. And wasn't Christianity's missionary enterprise just sort of part of that brutal story of repression? The actual historical answer is no, not really, or at least not entirely. I mean, there were a lot of missionaries who probably did things the wrong way, who tried to impose too much European culture along with the gospel. But on the whole, there were a lot of very good missionaries who not only did not do that, but who represented represented really protectors who stood up against colonial aggression in a number of ways. And, you know, I'm just going through this quickly. When we're talking about colonialism, it really varied from place to place. None of the European colonial powers were particularly great in retrospect. There was a lot of brutality and repression all across the board. In some places more so, though. Belgian colonies in Central Africa. Belgium was particularly cruel. Portugal was often particularly cruel in its colonies. Britain wasn't great, but they tended to at least build up pretty decent infrastructure that then those countries could take over and make use of. So that's one of the things you still see playing out today in the post-colonial period, is it really often kind of matters which colonial power had influence over which country relative to how they're doing now. None of them did a great job, but in many cases, missionaries were doing their work in opposition to colonial leadership. You know, it wasn't that they were always walking hand in hand with each other. In many cases, colonial authorities didn't want missionaries in there because they're kind of messing things up in their plans. And missionaries had this tender-hearted tendency to protect the people that they're working with and to call out colonial governments when they got repressive and brutal. One of the leading names in this issue is David Livingston. I have a piece about him on the bottom of the J. Hudson Taylor sheet. David Livingston, there's a picture of him. He was a missionary. He's also famous as an explorer. And he sometimes does get a bad rap because, as you can see here in my notes, he hoped to aid the Africans by introducing Christianity, commerce, and civilization. And unfortunately, when you tie all three together, often what happened was a lot of injustice. We speaking of sort of European civilization, went in thinking that we are civilizing these people groups, offering them something. And it turns out we were often, you know, that was in many cases code speak for just taking away their liberties and using them for our own commercial advantage. There were benefits, of course, and I would say the spread of the gospel was one of those great benefits. David Livingston, although I think really is a character that is due some admiration, he was a complicated figure, did not do everything right, obviously, but he really cared for the local folks that he employed. So he went around with a team of local African guys, you know, from Zimbabwe, Zambia, Congo, the places where he was exploring. And he really depended on them. He cared for them. He worked side by side with them in many cases and really fought for their well-being. So when he eventually passed away, he's buried now in Westminster Abbey in London. I've been there. I've seen his grave. The interesting thing about that, though, is that his heart is not buried in his grave. He asked that his heart be buried in Africa. And so I, just by happenstance, I've also been at that place. It's on the coast of Tanzania, and there's a great big baobab tree that stands now over the place where David Livingston's heart was buried. So the story of Christianity and colonialism is complex, not always a good story, but, you know, I just want to give you guys the awareness that in our current environment, often you will hear the 18th century missionaries sort of talked down on as people who were just enabling colonialist oppression, enabling imperialist injustices. And that's not really an accurate picture, at least not of all of them. Many of these people, I would say most of these people, were sincerely seeking to spread the good news of Jesus Christ as their primary motivation. And yes, it did get mixed up here and there with some of the abuses of colonialism, but I don't think the missionaries deserve as much scorn as do some of the colonial authorities. The other thing to note too here, and we're going to get into this more in our next section in a couple weeks, is that you start getting indigenous missionary movements arising at this time, right? So I don't want to present it as just a whole bunch of white guys going in and being the heroes of the story. What you have happen actually really quickly in most of these cases is that you have that first generation of indigenous Christians, whether it's Africans or Southeast Asians, folks in India. You have major Christian leaders arising within that very first generation and then carrying the task forward. We're going to look particularly at some of the local indigenous African missionaries in our next section, who really have tremendous stories to tell. One of the major figures by the end of the 1800s in India is a man named Sadhu Sundar Singh. And he was, you know, an indigenous Indian man who was going out and presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ according to his own culture and really having tremendous results from that. So there's a great deal more to this story than just white guys from Europe and America going and imposing their beliefs on people around the world. I think looking at it in that way is just remarkably short-sighted. So that brings us through the first two major sections. I'll have us take our break here.